Hello, and welcome to the latest episode of the Dialogue Out Loud series. I'm Taylor Petrie, editor of Dialogue, a journal of Mormon thought. Today, I'm excited to have with me James Faulkner, an emeritus professor of philosophy at Brigham Young University and former senior research fellow at the Neil A. Maxwell Institute. In his recent article, On a Philosophy of Marriage, he offers a deep philosophical reflection on marriage and relationships and their place in the modernity and postmodern thought. This article is part of a special issue of Dialogue on the family in Latter-day Saint culture and thought. Jim, welcome. It's so nice to talk to you about your work.
Thank you. It's good to be here with you.
So you begin this really wonderful essay in a perhaps unexpected place, the story of Frankenstein. What does this have to do with the philosophy of marriage?
Well, I think it's fairly clear that Mary Shelley is talking about a kind of creation story, right? An Adam and Eve story where everything goes wrong. Mm-hmm. I mean, in more wrong than even the traditional Christian sense. And so that's what intrigued me was, what in this story is there about the, you know, what does it mean to be a lone man in the wilderness, you know, and what does it mean to be unable to have a companion relationship? And so that, you know, just thinking about that, I reread the story. I enjoyed doing that for obvious reasons. But as I read it, I thought this really does fit in with the way that I was thinking about things at the time and helps me give structure to this problem that I wanted to talk about.
So in many ways, you're diagnosing through Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, as well as through religion, and of course, the philosophical tradition that we'll talk about, a critique of modernity in this essay about what you call just simply the individual, especially in René Descartes. So give us a brief overview of the relationship between the concept of the individual and modernity and how it differs from pre-modernity.
Well,
that's a big question. Sorry.
Yeah, I was going to say. But the concept of the individual really is, in many ways, an invention of modernity. With, I mean, Descartes, the whipping boy, he's easy to pick on. But I think he is emblematic of what's going on in the 17th century in Western thought. And I really do have to emphasize that modernity is a Western thing, not necessarily a worldwide universal thing. And individualism is the kind of thing that gradually infects the rest of the world, but it just isn't a natural way of thinking about the world. Modernity, with Descartes, at least, it's easy to see because he turns to this, I think. It's the I thinking that makes me who I am and what I am. But then he himself recognizes immediately that raises a question of, if what I am is a thinking thing, how am I related to anything else out there at all? And his solution, if you want to call it a solution, because I think no one thinks it actually works, is to say, well, I can give you a rational proof that God exists. And so that's still me. I'm thinking it. But I know now that there is another being outside of me. And once I get that other being outside of me, I can work my way out of the problem and I can have relations to the world. But following Descartes, even the philosophers who think that his proof doesn't work continue to think that to be a person is to be a thinking thing. Later Nietzsche, I'm obviously paraphrasing here, but Nietzsche points out that this means they've forgotten that we have stomachs and arteries and hearts, and you know that we are more than just some kind of consciousness. Freud does this by thinking about subconscious. I'm not a Freudian on the one hand. On the other hand, I think that the recognition that even the thing that thinks, is more than some kind of explicit consciousness is a huge development for us. So by doing this, we've created a kind of metaphysical loneliness for persons. But prior to that, Westerners were, of course, we were different than other people in lots of ways, But one of the ways in which we were the same was that we thought about ourselves in terms of our relations. To be a person is to be a person related to other persons in this way, related to the world in that way, related to God in that way. And all of those things together are what made us whoever we were. Now, that had its downside, and, you know, that I might think that who I am is just a serf, right? And therefore, I have to be who I am as a serf. Modernity helped break the chains of that kind of political structure on the one hand. On the other hand, the cost was pretty high. So I think that one of the things that postmodernity has done is to say, let's rethink the modernity business without giving up the what it's bought as, the notions of individual liberty, for example, which has been very important to human development and the development of modern science. I mean, there are a lot of things about modernity that could be praised, but at the same time, it's necessary in some ways to recognize that we've got to find a way to undo those costs.
So for just to also clarify for people, when we're talking about modernity, we're talking about the Enlightenment era, the sort of post-17th, 18th, 19th century period up till the present for the most part, though there are, you know, of course, people pushing back, as you mentioned, which we'll talk a little bit more about. So it is as this modern era that we're discussing. And you're noting that there's been this inversion of the relationship between the individual and society, or the individual and other relationships, that happens in modernity. So why do you think that shift of putting the individual first has been so corrosive for relationships?
Well, I think the reason it has been is because it's made the self the center of the universe. And by doing that, it then has made it so that anything that I want to try to think about, I do have to begin with myself. And once I do that, then it becomes difficult to recognize how is any other relationship anything except something that I've created. So if you think about people like Hobbes and his contemporaries, there's this whole question of how do we build a society? And the question is, well, how do we build a society starting from me? But if I'm going to have to start with me, that means that I'm the creator of the relationship, but that puts the relationship as a secondary thing, and it's still mine and not something that is ours.
Now, you're interested in an alternative to this, and let's explore that a little bit. You point to ethics as being one place to kind of rethink this a little bit, as well as a number of postmodern thinkers that you turn to address their disagreement with modern individualism. How do you connect those pieces, and sort of what are the foundations for this alternative to the modern individual?
Well, one of the things, places I, as you mentioned, I think Aristotle's Metempsychosis and Ethics is a really important work. It's often been thought of as merely a kind of handbook for ethical teaching or something like that. But Aristotle makes a very important point when he is clear that he talks about the necessity of developing habits in order to have good character. But the point of that discussion is that I am who I am in my relationship with other people. I become who I am as I learn from them. And these habits that I develop, now they're not immutable. They don't have to be the way they are, but at least I begin with something. And what I begin with is something that I'm given by others. So that's a kind of ancient beginning to this that a number of thinkers that we label with this really very strange label of postmodern, who I think very few of them call themselves postmodern, but they get the nickname anyway. People like Jacques Derrida and his student Jean-Luc Marion, they are trying to think about how in a contemporary setting can I recuperate that way of thinking about the world. Right? How do I get that back? Another person is, I think, very important and even not very much mentioned is Hans-Georg Gadamer. He also is trying to, how do I recuperate my relationships with others and in a way that doesn't lose what we've gained, but at the same time restores this Aristotelian way of thinking about our relationship to other people. Mm-hmm. And so those are people that I turned to and read, talked with, thought about a lot as I've tried to think about. So what could I say philosophically about family based on that kind of thinking?
Now you go from, and we can kind of delve back into that a little right. bit more, but you go from the importance of relationships in general to marriage in particular here. And I want to just ask, what is so special about the marriage relationship in this challenge to individualism?
Well, for me, there are two thinkers who have helped me think about that the most. One is Emmanuel Levinas, and the other is Jean-Luc Marion. Both of them point out that the way in which we think about our relationship to others actually begins with love rather than just relationship in general. And for both of them, especially for Levinas, perhaps the first of those relationships is the relationship that a person has to his or her mother, right? That this is a relationship in which one learns, one is taught. It's inescapable, right? You have this kind of relationship, and that this is a way of thinking about human being that is not possible to explain in terms of merely individualism. Marion, on the other hand, he does talk about, a little bit about children, but not as much as he does about marriage. And his point there is that he says, Descartes, these names all flow together sometimes. Descartes gets it wrong when he says, I think, therefore I am. Because he says, if I really thought that way, I really can't hold on to that very long, because sometimes I'm really not thinking about myself, or I'm not, maybe I'm sleeping, I'm not thinking at all. I mean, what makes it possible to continue to exist this way? And he says it won't hold up to scrutiny, to phenomenological scrutiny. Looking at it in our terms of our actual lived experience, it doesn't make sense. He says, but it does make sense to say that if I ask this question, so what makes me worth being? You know, what makes it worth being who I am at all? And his answer is that I discover that I ask that question. Well, when I ask that question, the answer is someone loves me. Now, he doesn't think love here doesn't have to be some emotional experience. Obviously, that would be included. But love here means a relationship in which there's someone who cares for my well-being. Right. And if I recognize... To recognize that is to recognize that even when I'm not thinking about myself, the fact that there is this ongoing concern for my well-being means that I continue to exist. I have some way to explain my existence, and there's a foundation to what I am that goes beyond mere consciousness. Mm-hmm.
So you're not also just interested in restricting this love to marriage or these ideas of that is the only relationship. You do see marriage as a broader paradigm for other kinds of relationships. How does it act? Is that, and how is it distinct and both a paradigm for other relationships?
How is it distinct? That's harder for me to answer it, to be quite sure. I do see it as a model, as you say, for all relationships. And the way that it acts as one is to say that if I think about my relationships with other people, in the end, and maybe I'm coming too quickly to the conclusions here, but in the end, they come down to a question of what I call covenant. Now, not in a Latter-day Saint religious aspect, but covenant in the sense that there is a bind that's created between me, a binding created between me and this other person that comes from the other person. And that binding means that I am obligated. In this relationship in which someone cares for me, I am obligated. They care for me by, in Levi Nasa's terms, they care for me by giving me a world. They give me what I know. They give me my language. They give me all of these things that make it possible for me to be a me. And by doing so, then I become obligated to them. I have to give something to them as well. And that obligation is this mutual obligation is covenant. So I think that in the end, human relationships come down to this kind of covenant of love that we create with one another. And again, I think it's, when I talk about this with other people, it's sometimes really important to remind them that I'm not talking about an emotion. I don't have to have this deep feeling of emotion for every person I meet, because that's probably impossible. In fact, I think it's harmful to us when we try to think that the commandment to love everyone means I have to have that feeling, since I know it's not, you know, I meet a beggar on the street, I'm not going to have that feeling, and then I'm going to feel like I failed no matter what I do. But if I recognize what it means is that I have an obligation to that person to do what is best for them, and which doesn't necessarily, again, it doesn't necessarily mean what that person asks me for or wants. I might take thought and I might make mistakes, and I'm not trying to make things oversimplified here, but that it comes down to this recognition that I owe that person in virtue of the person, that in virtue of the fact that the person is in relationship with me, that we have a covenant and I have an obligation to fulfill my part of the covenant. Mm-hmm.
I love this piece so much for sort of its foundational reflection on love, on relationships, on ethics, on mutual obligation and care. Are there any things in it that we didn't get to that you wanted to discuss? I mean, there's a lot here, and I encourage everybody to read it and deeply and think about it. And we're just skimming across the surface here. But yeah. Any other major ideas?
Off the top of my head, no. And I'm sure as soon as we stop, I'll go back to, and I'll say, oh, dang, I could have said that. But I don't have anything that comes up, no.
Well, this was such a wonderful piece. I'm really excited to have it as part of this special issue. Thanks so much for joining us today, Jim. It's such a pleasure to talk with you and to hear more about the long reflections that you've had on this topic. We hope that our listeners have enjoyed the conversation and have learned something new. If you'd like to learn more, please check out James Faulkner on A Philosophy of Marriage in the winter 2024 issue of Dialogue, and explore other resources on this topic there. Thank you for joining us today. If you've enjoyed this episode, please share it with your friends and colleagues, and don't forget to leave us a review or get in touch with any comments or questions. We hope that you'll tune in for future episodes of the podcast. Please subscribe and rate the show, and be sure to check out the whole range of shows in the Dialogue Podcast Network.
Greetings. My name is Rebecca DeSchweinitz, and I'm thrilled to serve as a board member at the Dialogue Foundation and as one of the hosts of Dialogue Gospel Study. In each episode, which we record live the second and fourth Sunday of every month, we welcome esteemed speakers from a variety of backgrounds to share their insights and perspectives on the Come Follow Me lessons. Our aim is to spark meaningful conversations about the scriptures, to connect them to our personal experiences and to our understandings and explorations of the gospel. To stay in the loop with our upcoming lessons and this opportunity to engage with Mormon thought, culture, and belief, be sure to visit dialoguejournal.com and sign up for our newsletter. By doing so, you'll receive updates and timely links to join our live stream lessons. Additionally, you can catch up on our past guests and episodes by subscribing to Dialogue Journal on YouTube, Facebook, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Dialogue Podcast Network.